Good April the 7th to you, and welcome to the Soccer Central podcast. James Sharman here, as always, alongside John Molinaro. We're getting down to the wire. Big games this week in the Champions League. We'll get to those very shortly. Also, a lot of controversy in the MLS, JMO, with referees brandishing too many red cards.
So they say.
Yep, apparently. Well, we're going to find out Steven Sandor's thoughts on this. Not what you may think, actually. Anyone likes a hammer referee, but not Steven, apparently.
No. We'll get
don't like that one, but you've got to hammer the refs when you get a chance.
No, I guess so. That's right? Fair.
You have to. Champs League, though. The quarterfinals graced our television screens this past week. Tom Williams has been following them very closely, as always. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, listen, let's start with PSG, shall we, against Man City 2-2. Now, I love your tweet you put out yesterday. It says, if PSG Man City teaches us anything, is that money can buy you anything, but not necessarily a functioning defence. It made for a great game, didn't it? I mean, awful defending, but just a compelling match.
Yeah, I mean, you get different types of football fans. You get those who tend to turn their noses up at poor quality but high scoring fare, and then the rest of us who absolutely love it and love nothing more than defenders, you know, falling over on their backsides and goals flying in. And it was that sort of game. I mean, we've known for a while that City have got problems at centre back when Vincent Kompany isn't playing as he wasn't last night. Nicolas Otamendi is just a disaster of a centre-back. He cannot stay on his feet. But one of the first rules of defending, and you know, when he plays alongside an assured presence like Kompany, his shortcomings aren't as evident. But when he's playing alongside someone like Eliaquim Mangala, as he was last night, who himself is not particularly assured, although I thought he played quite well, actually, for once, it's a recipe for disaster. But actually, what was interesting was the extent to which PSG struggled defensively. David Luiz, I thought, was at fault for the first goal, made a really peculiar attempt to backheel the ball away when, had he perhaps tried to clear it in more conventional fashion, he might have succeeded. And I think the decision that Laurent Blanc made to bring Serge Aurier back into the starting 11 after this ban that he was serving for insulting half of his teammates on Periscope backfired, because he was at fault for the second goal, the crucial second away goal for City, that really puts them in the driving seat ahead of the return leg next week, giving the ball away in midfield and then overcompensating in his desire to atone for his mistake, failing to get a proper clearance on the cross, and then getting in a bit of a muddle with Thiago Silva, and Fernandinho scored. I suspect that that both teams will want to tighten up at the back next week, but of course David Luiz will be missing for PSG. And maybe Vincent Kompany will be back for Man City, so that might change things again.
You mentioned some, James mentioned some comical defending, and obviously there was some pretty comical errors. What did you think about PSG's first goal? I mean, that was just dreadful, wasn't it, Tom?
Yeah, I was discussing this with someone today. I mean, that goal is the legacy of the kind of collective will of almost all top-flight European teams to play football like Barcelona. What you saw last night was the legacy of tiki-taka, but tiki-taka sort of done, very unconvincingly. You know, traditional football wisdom dictates that you don't mess around with the ball on the edge of your own penalty area, that you don't pass the ball to players who are under pressure in that area, and that before you even think about knocking the ball around, you make sure you have a pretty clear 360-degree picture in your head of where all your opponents are. And City broke all of those rules last night with that goal. Joe Hart rolling it out to Fernando's feet. And then rather than rolling it back to Hart or playing it wide to Bakary Sagna, the right back, who I think was probably in quite a good position to receive the ball, he makes the cardinal sin of playing it across his own box without realizing that Zlatan Ibrahimovic is right behind him. And the next thing you know, the ball's in the back of the net. And, you could see that Fernando was absolutely devastated. He knew what a foolish mistake it was. But, I mean, this is something that we see increasingly, that the basics of protecting your goal have gone out of the window of late, because teams are so desperate to play possession football. And footballers like Fernando, you know, who is a perfectly capable player from a technical perspective, but I suspect that when he was learning the game, even as a holding midfielder, he wouldn't have found himself in that position all too often. So I think, you know, that goal, I mean, you know, you can't blame anyone but Fernando and perhaps Joe Hart as well. But it you know, it stems from this desire that all, you know, a lot of the big clubs seem to have now of, you know, playing the ball out from the back, no matter what the circumstances.
Didn't that, though, that goal almost epitomise City's season? We know what they should be doing, but it just seems that they switch off. And they switched off all year long in certain competitions, in certain games. And, you know, they shouldn't be conceding those kind of goals. They shouldn't be fighting for fourth place in the table, but it's happened.
They've had a very curious season, City. I mean, recently people have been saying that their big mistake was to announce that Pep Guardiola is arriving at the end of the season, because suddenly their form has just completely nosedived. But actually, this has been their problem all season. And even when they won the title under Pellegrini, but I mean, less so then, I suppose. But they've always had this vulnerability. And this season's been a very peculiar one, because they started the season in such impressive fashion. I think they won their first five league games without conceding. And everyone by sort of mid-September had decided in England that this was City's title to lose. But they do have this vulnerability. They've had a lot of injuries to key players. You know, Vincent Kompany has missed a lot of the season. Obviously, Kevin De Bruyne was out for quite a while, and he's had a very big impact in his first season. Yaya Toure is picking up more injuries now that he's getting older. And again, you know, the players that they've recruited to complement the City spine, which has been pretty much unchanged for the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. You think Joe Hart in goal, Kompany at centre-back, Toure in midfield, Silva and Aguero. That has been the spine now since, what, 2011, 2012? And the players they've brought in to sort of, you know, to fit around those players haven't always been particularly successful. I mean, I think they've signed catastrophically at centre-back. Otamendi and Mongala costing, what, £60 million between them? You know, neither have convinced. I think they're weaker at fullback. I think Sanya and Clichy, and if it's not Clichy, Kolarov get exposed quite a lot. Fernando and Fernandinho are both perfectly capable players, but, you know, just don't offer a huge amount. Jesus Navas is very inconsistent. Wilfred Bony has been a poor signing. You know, really disappointing since he arrived from Swansea. So even though, you know, you look at the names and you look at the amount of money they've spent, I don't think they've spent all that wisely. And you do get the sense of a club that is drifting a little bit. Certainly this season, since they made that fantastic start, they've never threatened to get back into that groove. I mean, it's quite astonishing. They've not won back-to-back league games since October, which for a club of City's standing, with the resources at their disposal, is absolutely shocking. And in the Champions League, you know, we've seen that a lot. You know, they've had a lot of poor results over the past few years. Yes, they've had difficult draws often. You know, that's some particularly unkind group draws. But, you know, they seem to sort of struggle to get up for the competition in a way. So, in actual fact, it was quite refreshing to see them play as well as they did against PSG, because I think most people would have seen that as a complete home banker. You know, PSG already champions of France and look to be moving towards the level of, you know, the European super elite, you know, Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Real Madrid. And they seem to have stolen a bit of a march on City in that respect. But actually, City showed that, you know, that perhaps the distance between the two teams isn't quite as great as you might have thought.
Did PSG struggle with the pace of the match yesterday, Tom? On the international broadcast that aired here in Canada, Martin Tyler was doing the commentary, and he sort of labored the point that, you know, they PSG doesn't play, you know, fast teams in Ligue 1, that they dominate, and they're just not used to, you know, the quickness of English teams. I mean, how much of a fact do you think that was?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a glib explanation, but I think there's a lot of truth in it. I think it's partly the pace of teams like City, but also just the quality. You know, there is no domestic opposition for PSG in Ligue 1. We thought that Monaco were going to provide it when Dmitry Ribolovlev bought the club and signed people like Falcao. But very quickly, he decided that he was going to change the project at Monaco, that it was going to be about recruiting young players you know, putting them in the shop window, selling them on for a profit, a sort of Porto model, if you like. Marseille are in complete turmoil at the moment. Lyon had a great season last season with a young team, a lot of academy graduates, and really gave PSG, you know, a run for their money last season, which no one expected. This season, they haven't been quite as good. And so PSG's nearest rivals are Monaco, who are something like 25 points behind them. And even when PSG play their big rivals, they know that there's a gear that they can kick into that is too high a gear for anyone else in their domestic league. But they can't do that in the Champions League, or at least they haven't been able to do that. And I something I've noticed watching PSG in the Champions League is how complacent they are when they're in possession. I mean, Thiago Motta is not having a great season, but for me, he's been symptomatic of that. In that, you know, as the midfield anchor, he's the guy who's really got to set the tempo. And his ability to do that in Ligue 1 has been absolutely central to the success they've had domestically. But when it comes to the Champions League, he seems to forget that he doesn't have the same amount of time on the ball. And you see guys like Blaise Matuidi, who is a sensational footballer. He had a very, very poor game against City. I think part of it is being taken by surprise, you know, forgetting that, you know, you can't just cruise through matches like this. And also, you know, without being unkind to Liga and its leading teams, you can give the ball away in Liga, and, you know, the chances are, you'll probably get away with it because your opponents aren't going to commit men forward in the way that a team like City will. And, you know, City, for all their failings, have always been a very attacking team under Manuel Pellegrini. He loves getting players forward. He loves encouraging his teams to attack. And so they play with a sort of, you know, lack of caution that you don't find very often in Liga. And, yeah, it's something that has been, you know, a predictable problem for PSG ever since the Qataris came along. How are they going to sustain, you know, this level of performance when in France they have no, you know, natural rivals? I think it's valid to say that's partly, you know, an explanation for what happened against City.
It's a great point, and I wonder how that will affect would-be Ibra suitors. I mean, it seems very popular right now to say that this guy is one of the great players in world football, and it's tough to argue that, given his goal-scoring record, but he's been playing against French defences for the last two or three years now. Do you think that might have some bearing on where he ends up next season?
I wonder. I mean, he's been linked with a lot of English clubs at the moment in the media here. I mean, there's a lot of English teams who need strikers, Chelsea first and foremost, Arsenal as well, Manchester United, even Manchester City, you could make an argument, given they're very dependent on Aguero. I think there is wariness about Ibrahimovic here. There always has been. And until he scored those four goals against England in that crazy friendly in Stockholm a few years ago, an awful lot of people in England thought he was a YouTube miss. You know, that they saw the statistics from Italy and they see the odd, you know, highlight, but they've never seen him do it in a big game. And, you know, that performance against England was enough to convince everyone here that, you know, perhaps he was the real deal. But again, you look at his track record and, I think it would be going too far to describe him as a flat track bully. But when it comes to the Champions League, his record is poor. And he doesn't score anywhere near as many goals in knockout matches as he should. You compare that to, you know, to the modern greats, to Messi, to Ronaldo, and they do score at something approaching the same sort of ratio, almost regardless of the opposition, in the Champions League at least. So I wonder whether there is the clamour to sign him that certain media reports might lead you to believe. At the same time, I could see him coming to England and being a big success, but there is still that doubt about where exactly you place him. He's clearly one of the great strikers of the modern age, but, you know, is he an all-time great? I mean, he is a spectacular footballer and, you know, one of the most audacious players I think any of us have ever seen. I mean, the things that he tries off, the nature of the goals he scores, but, you know, perhaps he's better suited to a competition like Ligue 1 where he can bully teams almost single-handedly. And, you know, you sort of think if he was ever going to come to England, you know, is now the ideal time when he's 34, when most players are winding down? I suppose the flip side of that is that, you know, often people worry about players coming over to England and struggling with the pace. I mean, that would be a big thing for him to adapt to. But he's not got a huge, you know, he's not got much slower over his career. His game has never really been about pace. So that's perhaps not something that he needs to worry about all that much. But, I mean, it'll be fascinating. You know, you think his choice is basically, do I go for one last big sporting challenge in Europe? Or do I decide to move my career into a different phase, you know, go to the MLS, for example, which has been suggested as a potential destination. Wherever he goes, he'll be box office. He'll make all the headlines. People will fall in love with him. He will give the biggest boost in terms of confidence, professionalism, in terms of marketability to whichever club he joins. But I think the jury's still out on him as a player who is capable of influencing games at the very, very highest level of the sport.
Turning our attention to Atletico and Barca, Tom, you know, the Catalans coming back from a goal down to beat Atletico Madrid, who were reduced to 10 men after a pretty mad 10 minutes from Fernando Torres there. Atletico in the aftermath, not too pleased with the refereeing, kind of throwing around accusations of bias and you know, favoritism towards Barca. What was your take? I mean, on the two sort of yellow cards that Torres received, I mean, did he deserve to get sent off?
Oh, completely. I mean, one of the stupidest sendings off I think I've ever seen, in that there were two completely pointless challenges. The first one on Neymar, you got the impression that he was just sort of annoyed at the way that Neymar was sort of, you know, drifting across the pitch, you know, dancing past defenders. But I mean, this was, I think it was, the first booking was just after he'd scored, was it not? I can't remember the exact order of things.
Yeah. So,
you know, there's no reason why he should have been annoyed at that stage. And then 10 minutes later, he blunders into the back of Busquets. And the funniest thing was the fact that Atletico's players reacted so furiously towards the referee, because there were two absolutely clear yellow cards. And it was the only thing that Atletico got wrong. I thought they were absolutely superb. I thought their approach to the game was brilliant. And as good as Barcelona are, they will always give you chances. And if you have a striker like Torres or a striker like Griezmann, you know, you can back yourself to take one of those. And they were in the perfect position to get a smash and grab 1-0 win, which has become one of their calling cards under Diego Simeone, until Torres was sent off. You know, even after that, it looked like they might hold out. In the end, typically, you know, the Barcelona ended up winning. And ironically, thanks to a guy, Luis Suarez, who should have been sent off himself. Yeah. I mean, he could have received great red cards for two separate incidents. I mean, there was the crazy kicker at Juan Fran in the first half. And then in the second half, he swung his hand into a defender's face. But, you know, Torres's crimes were committed in full view of all the officials. Suarez's were typical sneaky Suarez, you know, sort of while the referee's back's turned. So Torres gets sent off. Suarez stays on, scores the two goals that settle the game. But at the same time, I think Atletico will take a lot of encouragement from the way they played. And, you know, if you were to back any team in Europe to grind out a 1-0 win at home, even against a team like Barcelona, it would be Atletico Madrid, because they are such a well-drilled team. They defend so well. I think they've only let in 7 goals at home in 15 La Liga games this season. 9 clean sheets. So they're, you know, they're a very, very capable team defensively. And if they can, you know, if they can nick an early goal and keep 11 men on the pitch, you know, you'd fancy their chances of really causing Barcelona some problems.
You're right, and Barca, of course, losing El Clásico on the weekend, and then obviously not in top form right now, so there might be an opportunity there, but I think we've heard that before, and then Barca find their mojo.
And prove us wrong.
Before you know it, you know, they're running off win after win. Tom, a great job as always, mate. Enjoyed this. Thanks so much, and we'll chat to you real soon.
Thanks for having me.
That is Tom Williams. You can follow Tom on Twitter, at TomWFootball, and yeah, Suarez was lucky, but like Tom mentioned there, that's what he does. He's a master of the dark arts.
Yeah.
He does things and generally doesn't get caught for them, aside from biting people, and that's usually retroactively. But yeah, I mean, Atletico, I wouldn't say they figured out how to beat Barcelona, because Barca have owned them in many ways over recent years. Never really a blowout, mind you.
Right.
But I mean, there's no real right way to play Barcelona. We've tried that. Do you defend? Do you sit back? Do you go at them? But maybe a combination of both. And Atletico, certainly if any team has the opportunity or the knowledge, the know-how to find a way through Barca, it's going to be them. But I just think Barca's too good. Simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, I've been quite impressed with Atletico Madrid all season. I thought, you know, until Torres got sent off, they were sort of bossing that game. And, you know, they looked quite comfortable containing Barcelona. So that was the game changer, because then Barca just, you know, continued to chip away and chip away and chip away. And then finally, whatever it was, with about half an hour left, the breakthrough and then another goal. So it was, I would have liked to have seen, you know, had Torres not been sent off, if it was 11-11, would they have been able to grind out that 1-0 win? I suspect that they would have. But I think Tom is right. I think if any team is capable of grinding out a 1-0 win at home to advance to the next leg, or even against Barcelona, then it's Atletico Madrid. So it sets up very nicely next week at the Vicente Calderón.
Bayern Munich beat Benfica 1-0. Arturo Vidal scoring.
Yeah.
Is it a more underappreciated player, do you think, in the game right now?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I absolutely think
he's
so.
He's wonderful.
I don't think he does a lot of things flashy. I don't think he's not a flashy player. I don't think he's particularly outstanding at a lot of different things. I think he just does a lot of different things really well that kind of go unnoticed. I think he's, you know, strong on the ball, and he'll very very tidy in possession. I think his passing is very solid as well. I think he's just an all-around, like, general out there with a midfielder. So I think he's an excellent player. Doesn't quite get his due.
And you watched Juventus every game last year, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
I saw him in and out. So you can give a pretty educated opinion.
I think so.
On what he is. I agree. I'm a big fan of his. Wolfsburg beat Real Madrid 2-0.
That's
a shocker.
Crazy, eh?
Big shocker. Julian Draxler.
What a game.
He's been promising us for a long time what he can do, and he's been hurt a lot, and that's what's really set him back, I think. But he's still very young. And man, he was in top form, wasn't he?
He was
incredible.
He was fantastic in that game. I mean, he was, for me, he was the best player on the pitch in that Wolfsburg Real Madrid. And that's in a game with Cristiano Ronaldo, Gareth Bale, and Karim Benzema. So he was absolutely fantastic. I mean, full credit to Wolfsburg. I mean, it's funny because they've been pretty mediocre in the Bundesliga. I think they're eighth place. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're doing pretty well in Europe. I mean, this is their first quarterfinal, and they're going, you know, to the Bernabeu next week with a 2-goal advantage. That's not bad. You know, they score in the first half and they go up 1-0 in that, then
watch out.
Then it's over, you know.
And they're really just fighting for this tournament, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's a great story.
And I do too.
I've always liked Wolfsburg. I mean, they spend a few years ago, they had the world record transfer, I believe it was, for Brazilian. Oh, my brain is still working. Who was it? Who was it? Completely forget now. It was a real surprise.
Right.
And they paid a lot of money for him. But anyway, they spend money.
They do.
And they'll probably spend again. But I imagine with Draxler playing like that, there's going to be some massive bids coming in from him this offseason. And they'll do a lot to try and, you know, push those away. But I could see Draxler moving, unfortunately. But that was an interesting result, that's for sure. Real Madrid coming off that big win against Barcelona, where they were excellent, and then losing to Wolfsburg in this one. Just saw a great tweet came down here. John Terry, good old John Terry, he's actually...
What's he done now?
Nothing too bad. Well, nothing too salacious, really. He's revealed his votes for Team of the Year in the Premier League.
Oh, okay.
And what strikes me, he's actually Instagrammed his selections, and what strikes me is he's got beautiful penmanship. Have a look. Well, very girly writing, though, that kind of bubble writing.
Oh, wow, yeah.
But it's beautifully done. Big gaps between the names and the words, though. Now, I wonder, there's experts who can look at someone's handwriting and decipher who they are, their personality traits.
Right.
I'd be fascinated to find out what one of those experts would have for John Terry.
Wow, that's very good penmanship.
He's meticulous,
I must say,
man.
Yeah.
So, not too many critical selections. Kasper Schmeichel in goal. He's got Chris Smalling at right back, which is a bit of a surprise. He's not right back, but he's had a great season.
Right.
Fair enough. Robert Huth and Wes Morgan are his centre backs. Loving Leicester, apparently.
Mm.
Ryan Bertrand, left back, which I like a lot. Had a very good season. He's got Riyad Mahrez, Danny Drinkwater, Dimitri Payet, and N'Golo Kante in midfield. So again, three Leicester players there. He loves Leicester.
Well,
loves
good him. For him.
And Jamie Vardy and Harry Kane up top.
Well, I don't have too many problems with what
he's got. Mahrez as player of the year, which you can't debate. Maybe Payet.
I wouldn't have much of a problem with Mahrez winning it.
Not at all. So, well done, JT.
Yeah, good
for him. I support those selections overall, and your penmanship is absolutely beautiful. Congratulations.
You should see my penmanship.
Oh, mine. Here's my notepad. This is awful. I mean, you think a doctor's got bad penmanship? And I've got a different style in every page.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I think speaks a lot about my brain.
I'm the same. You should see like my signature, the way I sign checks. It's like it's totally unrecognizable. And I'm changing it. I'll just write JFM or whatever.
But nowadays we don't need to write.
Well, that's true.
Right? We don't.
That's true.
My daughter's learning at school writing and A's and B's and stuff. And
right.
She's learning a cursive style, which is very rare to find nowadays.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's beautiful. Like, she writes better than me and she's 5 years old.
Wow. She's probably better spoken too. So.
Well, it's not saying much, is it? But nowadays you type.
I know.
Just type. Writing's for losers.
Yeah, I know. It's like no one writes letters anymore.
No, I know.
You know what I mean? We're all writing emails or texts.
My aunt, who's in her 70s now, you know, she used to write me letters as a kid. Now they're emails.
She's emailing? Good
thing.
For her.
I get cards from her, which is nice.
Sure.
But yeah.
We don't really write letters anymore. I'm sure to a certain extent we still do.
Who does? Anyone out there writes letters to anyone, let us know. Not from jail.
Yeah, that doesn't count.
That doesn't count. You have less access to the interweb than we would, but I don't know. I guess you can't trust Canada Post. That's probably the main reason. Before I forget, we should go over the weekend broadcast schedule for the Prem, as we're kind of on a Premier League tilt.
Sure.
Because I will forget otherwise. Saturday, 9:30 on Sportsnet 1, Watford, Everton. Crystal Palace and Norwich on Sportsnet 360. Is that right?
Yeah.
Palace, Norwich, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. City and West Brom is the late one. On 360 and on Sunday. Oh, Sunday's going to be
big fun.
The early one, 8 Eastern on Sportsnet 1. Sunderland, Leicester. All right. That's followed at 10:30 on Sportsnet 1 by Spurs, Man United.
Two big games.
Man. Leicester could be 10 points up.
Could be.
And that's how it goes this weekend on Sportsnet. Big games, huge games, especially on Sunday. A lot of controversy in the MLS, as mentioned before, with refereeing standards.
Yep.
Once again, no one's happy apart from Steven Sandor. In fact, Steven Sandor celebrates all things Major League Soccer officiadom. Big supporter of refereeing and what's happened so far. Steven joins us now. Steven, all right, 4 match weeks into the season, 16 red cards so far. 16. 6 players with a retroactive bans, yet you say there's no problem. Explain.
I'm not saying that there's not a problem, but I don't think any of us should be surprised by this. In early March, Peter Walton, the head of Pro Referees, which is the organization that looks not only after MLS, but NASL and USL games as well, said that he felt that the referees last year missed 30% of the red card incidents. So this was a big public humiliation of his own staff, saying, you guys missed, you know, that's a significant number of calls, and I expect to see more. This goes back quite a few years, actually. It's in 2011 and 2012, MLS, when they created Pro Referees, or when Pro Referees was created, one big part of their mandate was to crack down. MLS had a reputation before 2012, really, 2011, as being one of the dirtiest leagues in the world. And I think that anyone who remembers Toronto FC's first few years and being in the press box in those early years of Toronto FC and how many times MLS officials and the teams and the GMs discussed that it was, you know, when they tried to attract players into MLS, that was one of the things agents brought up. You know, your league is really dirty.
But then Dickie retired.
Yeah. Yeah. Kovalenko retired. Ricardo Clark isn't around so much anymore. You know, some of those guys went. But at the same time, I think those things were so high profile. And then in 2011, you had, you know, this perfect storm where Steve Zakuani's leg was shattered. And that, let's face it, that was probably one of the most watched highlights in MLS history. More than any goal, more than any, great MLS Cup moment, was Steve Zakuani basically getting a career-ending revenge tackle from Brian Mullen. And then a week later, Javier Morales goes down with an injury. At the time, he was probably the second best player in the league. And then David Ferreira goes down, who was the best player in the league at that time with a tackle. And there was a perfect storm. And MLS, again, went back and said, we have to crack down. We have to look at how dirty our league is. And so over the years, they've had several mandates to their referees to amp up the red cards. This year, they've upped it again. They want that ball carrier to be protected at all costs, and they want these players to be protected. And, you know, as I said, the spillover effect, we're seeing it in NASL as well. We've already had some interesting calls Because, again, pro referees, they administer all the leagues. It's not just an MLS thing. It's a North American soccer thing. And it is a it's an interesting move where I think you have to ask yourself, has MLS looked back at its own history and overreacted and overcompensated? Or is this just the new normal, as we're seeing in all sport, really? I mean, all sport is getting much more hypersensitive about injury and such. And, I mean, we're seeing it at every level, whether it's in hockey and baseball, in soccer as well. Like, we are seeing rules being reinterpreted to protect players at levels that they've never been protected before.
Well, it's an interesting point about, obviously, listing all the back history and how we got to this point, but it's an interesting point you raise about the question you raise about, have we gone too far? Because, I was at TFC training this week and talking to some of the players, and they all acknowledged that, yes, we were told beforehand that this was going to happen in the preseason. They've had, they had meetings with the referees, so this didn't come as a surprise. And they, even someone like Will Johnson kind of expressed a little sympathy with the referees, saying, they're only doing what they're told. At the same time, he suggested that, that it's gone a little bit too far now, that, maybe that the standard that they're trying to, to break or to institute to protect players is gone a little too far, that it's, they break the standard too much. What's your thoughts on that? I mean, the Labba thing, for instance, that, him getting sent off last Saturday, there was a lot of sort of debate about that as to whether that should have been a red card or not. What would be your take on something like that?
It was interesting. I had an on-the-record discussion with Nick Ledgerwood, FC Edmonton's center midfielder, who, just spent, the majority of his career in Europe, Canadian national teamer, and has come back to play in North America. And again, same standard of refereeing. He's playing in NASL, but again, under that same umbrella, under the same mandates. And he said already what he's seeing from the MLS games he's watched now and the games that he's played in, which is just one NASL game so far, in which an FC Edmonton player was sent off, that he said that what surprises him about the refereeing in North America is how unwilling the referees are to talk to you as a player. Like, basically, there's none of those talking to's that we see in Europe where, let's say, in the first foul, or especially early in the game, a referee will just sort of give the calm down talk that we see so often in Europe. Like, it's okay. And he said, I think the referees there have a better understanding of the occasion, that, like, if it's two rivals playing each other, sometimes the blood boils. If it's a bad foul but not necessarily an intentional one, they'll talk to a guy first. They'll try to calm him down. They understand people are paying for tickets. They understand that, that people want to see competitive 11v11 match. So he said that, but that seems to be the option that the referees here don't take. The option is always sort of disciplined by card, and it's really hard to talk to the referees here. I think that's a big part of that sort of discussion or that debate that we're seeing happen. And I think, again, the referees are under such pressure to show cards right away that they almost feel like if they do give a player a talking to, it's going to get scrutinized by the bosses up top, and they're going to get scolded for it.
Yeah, it's a great point there, and you're right. I mean, you watch overseas football, wherever it's from, and the good referees do bring players aside, talk to the captain, little warning, next time it's going to be a card. You see it all the time. I wonder, though, the lower the quality you go to, generally the more physical it is. You go to the England's League Championship, for example, right? I mean, it's not as bad as it once was, but it's still, at times, a bloodfest. It's a very physical brand of football. Do you think MLS, and you mentioned how it used to be considered dirty, but is it still considered a very physical brand of football, brand of soccer, which makes it difficult for the referees?
I think so, and I think you talk about players. They always talk about how athletic this league is, and yeah. I think what MLS has always had in its corner is that what it may have lacked in that sort of fine skill, it's made up for in the fact that how the players like to get up and down the pitch, simply because of the athleticism of the players involved. So you have a lot of really just running at each other. The criticism of MLS, it used to be just too much running around pointlessly, and that sometimes you couldn't tell formations, or you couldn't tell really strategies teams are trying to play at each other. The nuances are starting to come into the game now. But I think that MLS is and I think that's a danger you create when you create a designated player system, when you create a system where you're basically telling your fans and everything about you that one set of players are more equal than the others. I think we know that in other sports. Like, I'm not going to say that people don't think that Lionel Messi is a little bit above everyone else in the Spanish league. if he was tackled. But there's no sort of salary designation that sort of that, and they don't put that in front of his name that says he's the special guy. In North America, we do that. And I think that we create this sort of level of pressure for the officials that these guys have got to be protected, that, you know, the league has gone out of their way in a lot of cases to bring these guys into the league, and these guys have got to be treated with kid gloves. And I think, you know, you're seeing more and more to attract, and again, MLS is still in that sell job, that they want to go to agents worldwide and say, this is why you want to play here. This is why you want to come here and boost our league. And immediately they don't want guys thinking about, well, you know, this is going to happen here. I'm playing on turf. I have to fly all the time. Like, all of the negatives that come with selling MLS to a player, I think that's sort of one of their sells, is that, you know, you're going to be protected here. I think that that's something that they think about. And I think players know that tackles on them will be treated harshly. And I think until you get to a point where MLS isn't, you know, having two or three different standards of players with prefixes before their names, DPs or TAMs or what have you, you've created this culture, and now this is what you've got, and you're protecting players, and you're thinking about how to not get these assets, because they're seen as assets, not players, hurt.
Steve, aside from, you know, the referees clamping down on these certain types of tackles, there's been, you know, other controversies so far this season. You know, Benoit Cheyrou with the second yellow against Colorado last week, Didi elbow Burling, and then, you know, in the game before in Kansas City with Justin Morrow getting knocked off the ball inside the box, and then Kansas City going on to score. You know, those two plays in particular, not to point out Toronto specifically, there's been others, but there's been some calls that have really gotten the ire of fans and players and coaches up, and it's led to a lot of debate as to whether instant video replay needs to be instituted to replay stuff like that. What's your take on this?
I would say if you think replay would work on this, then you've obviously seen all of these decisions that have been overturned by the disciplinary committee when they do have a second long look at them. Oh, wait, none of them have been. The fact is, there's a certain, I think, hubris that comes with this, this assumption that, oh, if the referee would have another look at it, he would change his mind. Well, no, you're not the referee. The referee might not change his mind. You might find the referee says, you know, by the way that I'm supposed to call the game, I'm fine with that. He might say, you know, and referees, I got to tell you, I've known quite a few that I speak to, retired or guys who reffed in the leagues right now. And you know, obviously these aren't the kind of discussions that, you know, we're going to have on the record. But the discussions that you have are, these guys are hypercritical of themselves and their own work. I don't think fans understand how hard referees are on themselves, how they agonize about the calls that they make in a game, and how they look at what they've done over and over and over, and how they're scrutinized, and the amount of pressure they're under, because they don't have those. And this gets back to replay. They don't have that second look. My fear is always, I love the idea of replay on goal line, and deciding if balls go in, you know, maybe penalty box incidents that, you know, could lead or might not lead to penalty kicks. But my problem is that in every sport that we've seen replay introduced, it's getting abused. I mean, I've covered enough NHL games this year where there's been coaches' challenges after a replay where they're challenging the replay decision. So we're going back and sitting around for 15 minutes, twiddling our thumbs while they're reviewing the replay of a replay. You know, in the NFL, it's out of control, where the games are now almost 4 hours long. I mean, so NFL fans don't seem to care. It used to be, okay, there's big moments that a coach wants to review, but they're doing first downs now where it's like, really? You don't think you can get that half yard over the next three downs and you have to review this if you got a first down or not on first down? The things that they're allowed to review and the scope of it is out of control. And I think that the problem that we see is the Pandora's box opens. And I got to tell you, one of the reasons that we're working here, John, James, myself, and all of the sports media, is because there's an element of error and an element of doubt. Mm-hmm. If we got everything right, guess what? There's not much to talk about.
Right.
We don't have that human element in the game anymore. Let's just put robots out there and have a robot like call the game and just enjoy that. It'll be like watching those those intermission or halftime games on the video screen where they show the cars racing each other. There's got to be a human element to it.
Right.
I don't mind, as I said. I think when you have a big moment like a goal and seeing if that ball crossed the line, I love goal line technology. I love the way it works. I love the way that it buzzes on the referee's wrist and lets him or her know that the ball went in. But I think we get into this crazy sort of I just think that the box opens. And once the box opens, you start getting challenges on top of challenges, and it gets ridiculous. And I'm fine with people instituting replay as long as there's a salient penalty for getting it wrong. If the coach gets it wrong, there's got to be some kind of penalty that goes to his team, where if the referee upholds his or her decision, says, look, I got it right, you slowed down the game, so what is that penalty? In football, they've got a little bit with it, with the timeout. Hockey's got to figure that out. I think there should be a minor penalty given to a team for delay of game if they get a challenge wrong. And I think in soccer there needs to be some kind of penalty. And I don't know how you would penalize a team for getting a challenge wrong. I just don't think that it should be just a la carte challenge, because it's out of control.
Yeah, I agree. But we all know that technology is going nowhere, and it's going to be refined and adapted. There's probably no perfect solution, but it ain't going anywhere, boys. So we have to accept it, I think, and find the best way to implement it. Stephen, as always, thank you so much. Really appreciate this. We'll hope to talk to you real soon.
Thanks a lot.
Stephen Sandor. Please follow Stephen at Stephen Sandor. You can read his work on Plastic Pitch and the11.ca. It's so difficult because refereeing isn't just black and white. There's so much subjectivity to it. I think all players ask for is consistency.
Sure.
That's all they ask for. League-wide, obviously within the game.
Yep.
But league-wide, and I think we saw that last week in MLS, there was such little consistency with what is a red card,
right,
what is a yellow card, what is nothing, right? It is extremely frustrating for players. And MLS hasn't got the best officials, as simple as that. But if you compare it to that level of play elsewhere in the world, it's very similar.
I think, and Steve kind of hit on the point as well without using this term, but I think what MLS referees have to be a little bit better at is game management. You know what I mean? That kind of like talking to a player early and not necessarily reaching to the yellow card right away, just kind of settling them down and just better manage the game. I think that's sort of one of the key as in terms of consistency as well. But I think this sort of a concept of game management for the referees really has to improve.
IMC, the panel at the OSA, Ontario Association's coaching conference summit this past winter. And on the panel, there are some referees and some officials. Carol Ann Chenard was there, Sylvia Pacescu, Hector Vergara, Ian Barker was there from the U.S. college side of things, Nigel Best, some really educated football people. And they were saying what they're doing more and more now is you're including referees in coaching seminars, in coaching programs, and coaches in referee seminars and referee coaching panels. And it's so important to gain that respect, because the big issue is lack of respect between officials, players, and coaches.
Sure.
But if you can have a referee sitting in a classroom with a bunch of potential coaches, even players, students, explaining their side of things, and vice versa, it can only mean good things. And these people who have been through it recently are saying this and being some really great results from it.
That's interesting. That's an interesting point. Yeah, it would make sense, especially if you can get to young players at a young
exactly.
time. And young coaches as well. That might be really beneficial. One thing we didn't want to talk about, I want to get your opinion on this, because this whole idea of a player goes down, and it's come up in MLS recently in the last 2 weeks. A player goes down, his teammates kind of stop, and then the other team is kind of pressured into playing the ball out. I've always hated this. And because, on the principle, yeah. I mean, if a guy is legitimately hurt, then the opponent should kick it out. But you know as well as I do, Sharms, like, guys are milking
How often are they carried off the field?
Yeah. And how often are they legitimately hurt? I think there's a difference between being hurt and being injured, right? So,
The
referees are, they let play carry on. And unless it's a head injury, then they're instructed to stop it. So I'm not sure why teams are kind of like suddenly stopping. If a referee says play on, then play on.
What was the first thing you were always told when you played football as a kid?
Play to the whistle.
Play to the whistle. The referee is the guy in charge. He'll tell you when to stop playing.
Right.
It's up to him. And he can generally determine if the player's really hurt
exactly.
or not. And you're right. Head injury, absolutely stop play. but 99% of times, I see it every weekend in the Premier League and the Serie A. It drives me at the wall as well.
And I have an idea, if you'll indulge me. I want to hear you get your idea of this. I've long contended, and I've been saying this for years and years and years, that when in this situation, a player goes down, you know, his teammates kind of stop playing and they're kind of like forcing the other team to play it out. I've long said, yellow card. Yellow card for the team that kicks it out.
Sure, okay.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Because essentially, I see it as a form of dissent.
What if, though, yeah, you know, yeah, because you're essentially going against the referee's
right.
wishes.
Now, caveat, if
players if really
I,
hurt.
No, what I was going to say, if you're on my team and I kick it out, as opposed to the other team kicking it out, but if I kick it out, then the opposing team should sort of, then that's okay. I wouldn't give a yellow card for that because you're essentially giving up possession, right?
But the what happens, though, is the opponent will still give the ball back to you.
But that's fine. But that's fine. And I would expect them to do that. But I just hate this idea of like my guy is down and you're in possession. I expect you to kick it out.
Yeah.
And if that opposing team does, then
fair
I would
enough.
Say give a yellow card.
I think it's a good idea. Yeah. I
See,
do.
There you go.
Because you're trying to do the referee's job and it's
right.
not your job. There's a guy in black who's being paid to do that job.
Exactly.
Do it.
Yeah. And as I said, we know guys are milking this now. I remember when it first instituted.
Some players that do are just renowned for it too. Yeah. They're rolling around like they're being shot. Oh my word, we better kick the ball out now. This guy may never play again.
Right. And how many instances are like guys legitimately hurt? They have yep. to be carried off. That
or injured, even being hurt, still play on. Right.
Exactly.
You may not be able to get up and run away. You got a nasty gash to your leg or a knee to the thigh.
Right.
Too bad. That's the game's physical. It's tough.
Right.
It's part of the game. Right. And if you're limping around. I think it's the other team's prerogative to take advantage.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Why should they give up possession just because
this
you're hurt?
Wussification of sports, man. Filling yeah. my head in. I'm sure you watched the Jays game this week with the slide.
Whatever.
I was so happy that Steven mentioned that. In baseball, I saw your eyes
like
roll.
Like it matters.
That was ridiculous, though. Anyway, listen, we're out of time. I've mentioned the Premier League weekend already because I knew I'd forget otherwise, but I remembered and here you are.
Yeah, there you go.
Amazing. Hope you enjoyed that, guys. Our thanks to Tom Williams, to Steven Sander, Brett Gunning behind the glass, John Molinaro. I'm James Sharman. Cheers for listening.